David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 341. I'm your host, Steve Raker, with a little bit of a frog in my throat, along with Andrew the L.A. Rabbit.
Hey, folks.
And Kevin, WWX Kev.
I have a little dread. No, I don't have any good punchline.
We are here for another episode of Marvel-y goodness, this time with a little bit of a twist. First, I'll say that you can find information about new episodes of Marvel Noise and correspond with us on our Facebook page and at Marvel Noise on Twitter. You can find new and archived episodes of the show on marvelnoise.com. And as always, we are happy to be part of Derek Coward's Deliberate Noise Network, where you can find other fine podcasts such as Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show, that is our outlet for when we need to talk about things other than Marvel books.
And yeah.
Tonight is an odd episode because we are talking about something that's near and dear to my heart, and that is Jim Starlin's Dreadstar series that was under the Epic comic book line of comics. And, well, is it indie? Is it Marvel? Well, it's both, especially in its origins, since it really became what it was to become in a transformational kind of a way, just like the Metamorphosis Odyssey is entitled. So we are going to cover the first 10 issues of Dreadstar here on this podcast, and then do our very first inter-podcast crossover with our own other sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where we'll cover issues 11 through 21, I believe.
Genius idea, Steve. Genius. Way better than my idea when we would April Fools with the deep sea.
Yeah, I thought I told you we were never going to speak of that again.
I'm also very excited to be covering Judge Dredd this episode.
Well, what I like is we're switching from our traditional Thunderbolts and New Warriors roles, where now it's Steve is the super fan. I'm the guy that read these just back in the day and read the good stuff, so quote unquote, and Kevin is the new guy. So we've all traded hats for this segment, which I think will be a lot of fun.
I'll have some grumpy comments or something.
Oh dear.
Yeah, you gotta do my job. Be the modern grump complaining about old comics.
And part of the catalyst for doing this now is that last year in 2019, Ominous Press, our friends at Ominous Press, ran a Kickstarter campaign where Jim Starlin had updated the color files and the separations, etc., on the, you know, moving them from film to digital, basically, and doing it with more care than the slave labor graphics folks did over a decade ago. And we have new copies of these Dreadstar issues, new collections in nice big honkin' oversized hardcover omnibuses. So get your ominous omnibus of Dreadstar. They've had one Kickstarter so far. I bet you they're going to do others. And if not, I'm sure this stuff is available or information about when they'll become available over on ominouspress.com.
Or if you're like me, you scrounge together some issues that have Epic Comics on them, and then you didn't realize at some point that they also did Dreadstar and Company, which is seems to be the inferior reprint because the paper quality is better on the originals.
Well, right. Well, the Epic line was a direct market only, creator owned. We'll get into it a little bit when the line gets formed. In the timeline of talking about this property, but the Dreadstar and Company issues came out sometime after, and they were newsstand, and it was a way to bridge that gap to let, because the newsstand was still a valid you know, source of gaining readership, and people are still buying off the stands. So it was a way to let people know that this stuff existed and, you know, come find it in your local comic shop. Kind of like how the first, there was a few other series, I think, that Marvel did where they did, like, the first issue or the first couple issues were, you know, on the newsstand, and then it moved to direct market, or maybe I'm just confusing it with the Kazar, Moon Knight, Micronauts, you know, publishing strategy of moving them to direct market after they had already been newsstand for a while.
I remember just buying the Dreadstar issues from the comic book store. I really liked the Epic line and tried to buy it when I could, but I think we've talked about that. I didn't have a lot of options in distribution, even for a company like Marvel, and those like rural shops could be a little weird sometimes, even though it was probably better than today. So I didn't always get everything. So it was nice having a newsstand alternative, because a lot of stuff was on both. So,
yeah, by the time the Dreadstar comic had come out, I already was familiar with the character from the Marvel graphic novel that had preceded it, as well as some appearances in Epic Illustrated, where I didn't have the whole Metamorphosis Odyssey, but I had enough of it that I got the gist of what was going on. So I already had a steady, reliable LCS by the time, and local too, between my school and my home, and I walked to school. So it was like I could pass it every day on the way home. It was great. So at the time that this book came out, the Epic line started with Dreadstar number one, I was already trying out every, and I do mean just about every number one that was an indie book that was being released. Baxter Paper, Wraparound Colors, Blood, Guts, Boobies, you know, all that stuff was very interesting to me as a double-digit preteen.
Yeah, that black and white boom was crazy. There were all kinds of weird books that many of them only had a number one, or at least I only ever saw the first issue.
So the same as today.
So Dreadstar began as the Metamorphosis Odyssey that preceded it. It was a three-part tale, epic, if you will, and rightly so, it would appear in Epic Illustrated, the first chapter of the Metamorphosis Odyssey that was entitled that, in Epic Illustrated issues 1 through 9 that ran over 2 years from 1979 to 1981. Actually, last year was the 40th anniversary of that material, and I think that's why the Kickstarters were done to reprint this stuff. Starlin had painted some science fiction novel covers, and so the next step, he figured, was to do sequentials painted. So he wanted to paint a sequential bit and came up with this science fiction fairy tale with a lot of Arthurian undertones, you know, even a magic sword and everything. And he also wanted to work out some issues that were, you know, he was wrestling with from having served in Vietnam. You know, he didn't want it to be a Vietnam story. Much better to use allegory, and I mean, that's what everyone was doing with science fiction in the 60s and 70s, right? And, you know, to be involved in a conflict that seems so bad that you'd rather just wipe the whole thing clean and start over, or just rip it all up. And that's what he gave us here. We get Akhnaton, who is an alien from a race of powerful mystic intellectuals, and his race creates this ultimate nullifier type weapon, a infinity horn that would destroy the entire Milky Way galaxy, to use as a last defense against this imperialistic Zygotian horde of this alien race, the Zygotes.
Steve, did you think of Drax and his saxophone?
And when the Ossorians, or Ossorosians, I should say, that's Akhnaton's race, when they are destroyed by the Zygotians, Akhnaton seeks out three beings who are needed to sound the horn, and then a fourth one to protect them, who wields this power sword that he had created and left on this frozen wasteland of a planet millennia ago. And this is Vanth, who a human who has the sword. And he does protect them. He protects them from this enormous Zygodian militia as the three beings manage to get to the spot they have to and blow the horn. And they do it. They euthanize the entire Milky Way galaxy in order to save it from a slow death at the hands of these, you know, tyrannical aliens. Actaton protects both him and Vanth in a protective spell and puts them in suspended animation, and they are there for a million years, and they float over to like a neighboring galaxy from where the Milky Way once was. And when they awaken, Vanth, he's wrestling with the guilt and everything and kills Actaton with the sword, as Actaton had hoped. It's all really heavy stuff, but very well told.
I think one thing that I think that Star Wars doesn't get enough credit for that they take advantage here is that everyone talks about it like a space western, because it is. But I think the other thing it showed was that we as a public were cool with magic and space being combined together. Because let's be honest, the Force is magic. So I really like that this also follows that trend of, like, you can put your chocolate in the peanut butter and we're okay. Because I feel like there's that, you know, Asimov school where everything, the sci-fi is very hard and they've got robots and everything makes strict sense. But there's no reason why you can't have magic in space. So I really enjoyed those elements, because the Osirians, or however you say it, lean sort of into that Egyptian myth type, their image. They have like the headdress and all that stuff. And later on, you're about to get into some of the spell casting. And our lead guy, the Anachronon, or how, I'm not going to be able to pronounce any of these names. I call our main guy Vanth Dreadstar, anyways.
Vanth Astro?
So I just really enjoy that. And I think Star Wars showed that you can have magic in your space, and we're all going to be cool with it if it's a good story. That's all I wanted to add.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost that Lovecraftian, right? I mean, there's like a mysticism to the cosmos out there. I like that stuff. The second installment of the Metamorphosis Odyssey, the original trilogy here, is The Price. And that was in 1981, black and white painted, but from Eclipse. And actually later, where I'd first come across it would be the Dreadstar Annual number 1 by Epic, but they would colorize it, which had mixed results. But why he brought it to Eclipse was, this was a time where in the courtroom it had been decided that it was not legal for the big two to stamp that stamp on the back of people's checks, and then by cashing them, you were entering the contract that gave you up the rights to all the work, right? So they came up with new work-for-hire contracts, and several creators that we know as kind of those early group of indie creators in the Bronze Age in the 70s there, they all decided they weren't going to do the work-for-hire thing, the Bernie Wrightsons and Jeffrey Jones and Jim Starlin. So, as leverage on the creator-owned angle, he brings this property over to Eclipse and does a graphic novel. And don't you know, Marvel soon after would start a line of creator-owned graphic novels. So, in The Price, we're introduced to the post-Milky Way future universe, you know, after the events of the Metamorphosis Odyssey. And this is about Syzygy Darklock. His introduction and his origin story. He's a bishop of the Church of Instrumentality. In this galaxy, there are two giant forces that are at war with each other and have been for, an epoch. It's the Church of Instrumentality versus the ancient monarchy in this perpetual war.
Steve, you know, for a second, I thought of Nexus.
Yeah.
For me, it was, I keep hearing Church of Appliantology, Steve.
Well, Syzygy's brother dies by demonic means, and he becomes a doubter in the church and decides to seek power on his own for revenge. And he does. He levels up. But it costs him his arm, his legs, and his eye, which all get replaced with cybernetics. Then he confronts and kills his brother's killer, but he has a vision of his destiny and learns the way to even more power, but it comes at a price. And that price is he has to shove the girl he loves into a room where a snake-like demon rips her apart. It's brutal. Now transformed and empowered, he, in the end, confronts the Lord PayPal of the...
Lord PayPal.
The Lord Papal. And he leaves the church and seeks out Vanth Dreadstar, who was in his visions.
And that leads us to the graphic novel series. Now, I only saw some of these in the store, and that, this is going to make everyone laugh, but that $4.95 price tag, man, I didn't buy a ton of them, because you could buy an awful lot of comics back then for $4.95, so they That's true. I didn't load up on them. Like now, we all laugh, because $4.95 is cheaper than half the comics.
They reminded me of the Treasury editions that weren't really happening anymore at that time. And so, you know, captured my already nostalgia even as a 12-year-old in 1982 when the Dreadstar graphic novel came out. And they kept them up by the register at my comic shop, Andrew. So it was like they were stacked flat next to the register. And on the good paper and the good coloring, I bought every one of them. And, you know, it seems pretty obvious that Starlin was a big part of this publishing initiative from Marvel because he wrote and drew two of the first three Marvel graphic novels. And that was...
They were a good deal. I'm just saying that $4.95, I just couldn't swing it. Yeah. There were too many other issues I wanted to buy, and my budget didn't stretch to $4.95.
The reason why he did the two of the first three graphic novels was that Marvel wanted Starlin to do the death of Captain Marvel, but he kind of made it conditional on the Dreadstar novel as well. Fully painted in color, this third part of the Metamorphosis Odyssey opens moments after the serial from Epic Illustrated. Vanth is wandering Kaldor in the woods. He's just killed Akhnaton, and he drops almost dead from the Zygadian radium beam wounds that he took on while he was protecting the three from blowing the Infinity Horn and blowing up the Milky Way. The cat-human hybrid species of Kaldor find him, and the lone human scientist on the planet is a female, Delilah. She nurses Vanth to health, and they fall in love, marry, and live a happy farming existence for 30 years.
I love the odd coincidence that the one human is an attractive young woman.
Uh-huh. Right? Who looks just like Starlin's wife at the time. And Vanth doesn't age. There's something about being the wielder of this power sword that keeps him from aging. So for 30 years, things are cool, and he's living this happy life until Syzygy Darklock arrives, fresh off the events of The Price, and Syzygy befriends Vanth and mentors him for years until everything gets disrupted by the monarchy wiping out everyone on the planet except for Vanth, Syzygy, and one cat person, although we don't know that yet.
Katmandu.
This event drives Vanth back into, you know, battle mode after he had, you know, hung up his sword. It's the old gunslinger forced to pick up his holsters again, like we've seen time and time again.
Hey, you fridged their family, Steve. And they really fridge her hard. I mean, they don't just bomb the place. They, like, nail her up to a cross or something. I mean, it's not funny, but it's just weird that they went to those extremes. You'd think they'd be fine just killing all the cat people, but apparently we're there to send a message.
We learn that eventually at the end of this bulk of issues, don't we? So Vance, his plan is a great one. He joins the Monarchy army. What? The army of the soldiers that did the slaying. And he learns after a few victories that they really want to perpetuate, not win this war, because their economies are based on it and it's their power structure and everything else. So he rises in rank until he's stationed at the Royal Palace. And it is funny, though, he does send the squadron who did wipe out Kaldor on a suicide mission in one of his campaigns, which is funny.
The other thing I really enjoyed is the sequence done all on black pages, where he takes out these, like, living robot hybrid creatures. But because it's done on black paper, the only thing you see are Dread Star, the creatures, and, like, the laser blasts and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was a really nice way to show working on a black background versus, you know, because so many comics, it's the other way around.
And it's the classic Starlin fight scenes, too, where he drops the backgrounds, right? And you just get, like, the figures in a whole bunch of different camera angles dancing across the composition of the whole page. I love that stuff. So Vanth uses the opportunity of being stationed at the Royal Palace to kill the king and then pressure his son, the successor, to fortify their ground, stop all the frontline assaults, and alter their economy to survive in a non-war or post-war dynamic, basically. Then he has a reunion with Syzygy, and the next stop is to handle the Church of the Instrumentality. Now, before we get to Dreadstar number one, there was one other story, a 24-page black-and-white story at the very end of 1982 in Epic Illustrated issue 15 that bridges the gap between this stuff and the comic series. Here we have the last of the cat-human hybrid race from Kaldor, and see that he has joined Vanth and Syzygy, and he's also a stellar commando operative type and a pilot named Eddie. Eddie with an O.
Oh, I was going Odie, like from Garfield.
Eddie with an O. In a plot to steal a starship from an instrumentality mining post, which is the first step in the mysterious Plan M, Vanth and Eddie are slowed down when they have to rescue an innocent woman who's trapped under a fallen boulder, which they succeed in doing and steal the ship and rendezvous with Syzygy at the end of it all, although footsteps are seen in one panel that suggest that the rescued girl followed them from behind. Dun, dun, dun.
I was really hoping they would have worked in Plan M that they needed to get an asteroid.
Plan Marble.
Asteroid M. Great vacation spot.
And that leads us right up to the issues. Now this is where Kevin joins us in. And this is my exposure, was the issues. I remember buying these issues. I was spotty on Epic Illustrated. I liked the magazine, but again, it was one of those bought when I could, and I believe it was an elevated price as well. That and Savage Sword. I had got a few issues, but Andy didn't have a lot of money, so if you had a upsized charge on something, I didn't always get it because I'd rather buy. And then back then, quarter boxes were filthy, and sometimes you get like 10 for a dollar things too. So I would much rather raid a quarter box and get a whole bunch of comics than, I mean, that wasn't always the wisest choice, but.
Yeah, well, Epic was more expensive than Savage Sword too. Savage Sword was on newsprint. Epic had color pages and also was, you know, on the shiny stuff. So yeah, I totally get that. It was a heavy metal type magazine, you know, to try to compete with that on the shelf. But the Dreadstar comic series was the first in this new line of full-color, creator-owned Epic comics edited by, let's face it, everybody's favorite editor, Archie Goodwin, and his assistant, Mary Jo Duffy.
Yeah, and it's a shame. It's not like there isn't some other famous character that came out of Epic Comics that everyone knows I'm associated with, so maybe someday we'll have to talk about that one as well. I love the Epic line. They did those awesome, they even sometimes had just experiments in art and writers and new characters.
The paper was fun. Good. The paper was good. The backup stories, the wraparound color covers or pinups on the back covers, they were a fine line of books, and they really stood out on the shelf.
Now, Kevin, were these expensive back issues? Did you buy them a long time ago, or do you recall how you got your issues?
From the bargain bin.
Nice.
I mean, there's a lot of... it's weird, because, yeah, there might be like a lot of 90s stuff, but at certain times, there's a lot of 80s stuff from certain indie or indie-ish alternative publishers or lines.
You know, what's funny, too, is this is really where I learned who Jim Starlin was. I had read fill-in issues that he had done on Hulk and on Iron Man and Spider-Man even, and, you know, I'd seen covers, I'd seen the occasional Master of Kung Fu and what have you, but it was here in with the Metamorphosis Odyssey material and his work in Star Reach, in that magazine with the death stories and the god stories in there, that really cued me into who Starlin was and what his artwork looked like, because I was a creator guy. I liked to know who the creators were. Even at a young age, I could tell the different art styles and enjoyed training my artistic eye that way, and just like, you know, trying to name that tune and, you know, how many notes. I also used to like to be able to see if I could pick out who the artist was on a cover or in the book without necessarily having to look at the credits right away. And this is where I fell in love with Starlin, and then went back and read more of the Warlock and Captain Marvel stuff. A lot of that stuff was over my head because I, you know, now I'm 12 years old when this stuff comes out, and that's when they started coming out with those special editions on the Baxter paper that reprinted the Starlin Warlock stuff and reprinted some of the Captain Marvel stuff, along with the Kree-Skrull War and some other bits. I really enjoyed this era of Marvel. They really were dabbling in what to do with this direct market and how to use it and how to try to capture some of that indie quality.
Well, this was feeding my Star Wars fix. I mean, Dread Star is kind of like Han Solo and Luke Skywalker pushed together. He's got the laser sword. The Catman's like a Chewbacca type. They got the Princess Leia type. And then they got the old wizard. Like, it was... You know, I was a Star Wars kid, and this was like, wow, this is like a Star Wars thing. Sign me up.
It's funny,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it doesn't quite look like that to me.
The original Power Sword, before any of these stories were drawn in its design phase, looked more like a lightsaber, but then the Star Wars movie came out, and he had to switch it. But it looks better like an Excalibur, like it does.
Oh, it's not that close to Star Wars, but you have to remember, back then we didn't have the selection. Like, there was a lot of crazy stuff, but access to what came before wasn't a lot. Like, we didn't have... You couldn't just go watch the Star Wars movie whenever you wanted, so...
Yeah.
If things were reminiscent of it... I mean, I read the Marvel comic Star Wars, but I was also like, Star Wars-related media or things that were reminiscent of it was very attractive to me.
And remember,
I don't. He wasn't ripping them off or nothing.
Remember the thing about Star Wars too, that they didn't put it out on home, you know, on videotape to be able to rent in the video stores in the '80s, right? So it wasn't until years later that they decided to put it out on some sort of home video, and it, you know, went on HBO or whatever. But there was no rewatching Star Wars for a long time, and occasionally they would reshow. I think particularly right before the next movie came out, they would reshow the old ones in the theaters again.
Yeah, but then Andy, you know, cheap, didn't want to waste money on a ticket. That's comics, Steve. Buying a ticket, that's like I could get 3 or 4 comics for that money.
So these Dreadstar comics were 32 pages. It's a lot of story. The first 10 pages of issue 1 tell Eddie's story, as narrated by him, and shows how there's this galaxy-wide struggle between this monarchy that's in the core of the galaxy and the more or less invading Church of the Instrumentality that kind of surrounded on its periphery.
Kevin, did you get all you think? I thought this was, I mean, I guess he had to, but I do feel like if I had a criticism, it's a little wordy at times.
Yeah, the recap nature, like, I kind of wonder, like, it's a great history and everything, and I guess you want to fill people in, but there's also the, you get the sense that this book is going to be real wordy, and you're just like, wow, that's a lot of stuff going on. Like, if you don't know, obviously I knew, but still, I'm just like, man.
I felt the same.
That Synergy guy, that's what I call him. Seems like he looks like the supervillain, especially on the cover.
Yeah.
And it got the guy that with the He-Man sword, the green, the blue arrow with the He-Man sword, and then you have Scarlet from G.I. Joe punching someone out. And I'm just like, this is, and then the cats, you know, cats is fine, but it's just,
oh, you're just fine. Stuff.
I'm like, okay, I guess so. Yeah, I guess I'm down for this.
Kevin, you love cats, and they're just fine. I thought that'd be the character you'd dial in on.
He is the coolest character.
It is a little weird.
He's my favorite in the book. So there's this eons-old struggle that will never end between the monarchy and the instrumentality because it funds both empires and solidifies the power hierarchy in each empire. You've got King Gregzor leading the monarchy and the Lord Papel doing the instrumentality there. And Eddie tells of his life on Kaldor and the arrival of Vanth and the events of the Dreadstar graphic novel and how he's the lone survivor and now an integral part of the team. Also, Willow is introduced, another great comic book redhead. She's a blind telepath who can see through the eyes of others and travels with a monk-like creature that she sees through his eyes.
I feel like you could do this first issue some way better, somehow. I don't know how.
I feel like you're right. It's a big data dump in the beginning, Kevin.
Yeah.
That's pretty intimidating. The other thing I thought that could be played with a lot more is how disorienting it would be to perceive, to see through someone else. I mean, her telepath lets her know when other people are around, but just the weird act of seeing through someone else's eyes could be a fun, like they always have fun with Daredevil. How do you show his radar senses and stuff? And I thought they could have done more to play with that if they wanted to as a cool superhero sci-fi thing, because it's not looking through your eyes. You're looking, your body placement and awareness are in a whole separate spot from your point of view.
But like great fictional histories that exist out there in literature and in comics and stuff, you know, Tolkien among them, there's this history that goes back in this Metamorphosis Odyssey as well. And this Dreadstar comic just starts and picks up right here, and we'll go back and get little flashbacks as to sort of how the characters got to right here. But, you know, he's talking about stuff that existed elsewhere, and I think that's why it gets a lot wordy at first. But it also, this is the days where that was a editorial mandate to give you those recap pages, and it's interesting slowly how Starlin fades away from that over the course of the, or how he still manages to slip it in here or there, or just do it every few issues even. But yeah, I get it.
Well, also, once he gets to telling the tale, he's not overly wordy. It's just doing these data dumps are inelegant, but like the actual, it's a heist. The story's a heist. They go and jack one of the satellites filled with some of the wealth of the Church of Appliantology. Other thing that slightly made me a little sad was the precious metals and everything are still like gold and silver and platinum. I wanted some kind of like space credit, that they were going for.
No, like you want the gold press latinum because you can't replicate that type of material.
And they're soft.
I did wonder about the whole leaving wealth in space, and I'm like, well, why doesn't someone just, like, your mind sort of goes through the calculations or potential stories, and you're like, well, I wonder You know, obviously you need it fortified and all that stuff.
Well, the advantage is it's mobile. If there's an issue, you can, or if it's based on a planet, like you're sunken. If it's a planet, it might also be easier just to bomb it away if you're the enemy. Like, it'd be great to steal it, but if you could just destroy it, then they've lost their advantage. You know, you've hurt them. And this old Starlin, it uses nukes a lot, so they're not above. That's the other thing, is the body count in these things. Yeah. Like, galaxies go out. Like, they are not shy about killing loads of people. But I just love, I really enjoyed the various weird sort of robot-human hybrids.
Yep.
That are throughout this thing, and they're just fun designs of like crazy looking sort of late 70s, early 80s robot designs.
Giant mobs of Starlin cyborgs. I love it.
Almost like a Machine Man or Magnus Robot Fighter thing going on.
Yeah. But they're all different. Like, yeah. I mean, there are troops of the same, but he has loads of different designs, which I like, that it's not just here's what a robot looks like. It's got all kinds of goofy ones.
Different weaponry hanging off of them. The issue ends with a two-page sequence of the Lord Papal mysteriously requesting more power from the 12 gods of the instrumentality to deal with Vanth, Syzygy, and company, and the request is granted. Issue 2 is entitled Willow Story and is narrated by Willow.
Just one sec. All right, so Kevin, this was, you finished your first issue. Where are you at? What are you thinking? I just want to get his temperature in this. Because 2 is going to get... I had forgotten till I read 2, and then I was like, oh, that's right. Because I hadn't read these things in like 35 years or whatever, so I forgot until I got to that sequence. So let's be fun with number 1 before I get bummed out by number 2.
Even though there's like massive people dying in number 1 seems more fun than number 2.
Oh my, clearly. But we'll get to that. But I mean, I like
the number the 2 seems like every mature 80s comic.
Yeah, but you like, what about the like Lord Papal designs and robots and the action? What was your takeaway? You know, you
had it. I don't know if the, since you have a guy on your team, the good guys, I guess, theoretically, that looks really creepy. When you introduce your bad guy, he doesn't look any more creepy than the guy you have on your team.
I like that, though. You don't want all the bad... One thing I agree on the criticism of Tolkien, like, all the bad guys look bad and all the good guys look attractive. It's fun to have, you know, like, a good guy. You can't judge a book by the cover thing.
Lord Papal is such a Thanos, too, you know?
It yes. also like Thanos when they keep on mentioning the church and these ships and everything. Yeah, I can't think of like, you know, the like his other work or Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever. Like, it's imprinted.
These first 3 issues I read over and over and over again. I really like these first couple of issues because of how much information was in it, and also that, you know, I didn't know who Eddie was, so this told me, and I wanted to know who the heck Willow was and how she got there, and then this told me.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently she's the Phoenix, if you look on the cover of issue 2.
I had, well, I'll let you do this. I had forgotten about the turn until we reached those red-hued pages, and then I flashed totally back.
Crazy.
It was kind of cool to be like, oh my, like, I don't know if you've had, how often that happens to you when suddenly you remember, like, oh, that's right, I read this like 35 years ago, and it came all back to me. It's a hard scene, but anyways,
go on. I was hoping they weren't going there.
We're treated to another heist in this issue. This time it's Tech for the mysterious Plan M, and we meet the final member of the crew, Skivo, who is a hairy, purple, pointy-eared smuggler that the instrumentality wants dead. His role is to provide the comic relief and basically fill the role that the cinematic Rocket Raccoon fills on the team. Mm.
So I guess you guys don't get all the cool intros and outros.
No, I love
like there's no ads really to speak of, but like every issue it's like Archie Goodwin introducing the issue or whatever, or begging for letters or something.
What's funny about Skivo is that Starlin initially wanted this to be Pip the Troll and tried to buy Pip the Troll from Marvel. who refused to sell. And so it is said that Skeevo is the direct descendant of Pip the Troll.
Well, you also need a guy who's still plugged into society. Because remember, Sissy G and Dreadstar were off on a... and the Catman were all off on a out-of-the-way planet. And then Willow was in a mining colony, also out of the way. So you need, like, the guy that knows the cities and is hooked up and everything and can... I thought him more like Face from the A-Team.
Yeah, get him supplies. Make it happen. Willow relates how she was a tech on this remote mining colony planetoid when a cave-in occurred, and she was trapped under a giant boulder until Vanth and Eddie saved her, which recounts those events from Epic Illustrated 15.
Well, it's really mostly Vanth, let's be honest, Steve. I mean, he's the one that lifted the boulder. Although sometimes they say he's strong as 10 men, sometimes 20. And I'm like,
Well, it's one of those, you know...
Where's my Ohatmu?
Well, Willow followed them back and snuck aboard their ship and was discovered sometime later as a stowaway. Her latent telepathy powers emerged soon after, and Syzygy agreed to train her. While exploring a vision on a psychic plane, trying to figure out kind of what's holding back her abilities... Syzygy learns and faces with Willow a repressed memory of her dark history and her molestation as a youth by her father.
Man, I had forgotten, like I said, but there's a two-thirds page done in red tint. And when I got to it, I flashed right back. It was like Kevin said, maybe a little heavy, but this was, what, 82? I'm like 10 years older. Like, this is... pretty heavy.
Are you that much younger than me?
1972.
Oh, all right. You are. You stink.
So, sorry. So it was pretty impactful for a young man to read these kind of sequences. You're like, whoa, that's... And now it's, you know, a theme more readily used, I believe, and maybe even cliche, but back then... I was like, whoa, that was really hard.
Yeah, I mean, the color really makes it stand out, right? But also mutes it to make it seem like it's a nighttime thing, almost like an infrared view. And there's a whole bunch of little tiny panels, but there's no words, no captions or anything. And it's just a whole bunch of just slides of images back, and many of them repeated, just kind of getting the gist of the encounter. In the aftermath... Syzygy tries to convince her that it was not her fault and gives her a glimpse of the power within her own soul as it burns bright and white and innocent and everything. And she is astounded by it and breaks free of Syzygy and goes and dives into it. And Syzygy's like, no, you can't take on that kind of experience at your level. And sure enough, she got too close to the light, and it blinded her physical form when she returned corporal.
Never go into the light. Isn't that what we've all learned?
Not if you can help it. But she can see through others' eyes, and then she's given Rainbow, the little monkey that she sees through.
Well, she can't see through. Darklock always has his mystical power.
Right.
And Dreadstar also has the sword inside. In fact, he's the only one that suffers the least as far as normally in these things. I like that power always comes with a cost. And normally it's pretty bad. But he seems to have... I mean, he's lost personally, but physically he didn't suffer nearly as much as the other two.
In issue
three, and then there's an ad in the back here. Buy this book or I'll shoot this coyote. So apparently this coyote died, because I'm like, yeah, that didn't happen.
Hey, that was the first, I believe, first Todd McFarlane. I love that coyote book.
Englehart and Leah Loha's Coyote was one of the other first epic books, and it had the Scorpio Rose backup story that McFarlane drew after Marshall Rogers died.
And the first crossover with the first comics, Badger and Coyote crossed over. I have a page of one of the Coyote issues of original art.
Nice. In issue 3, Lord Papal declares the rebels Vanth and Syzygy the greatest threat the Church has ever known and puts out a galaxy-wide APB on them. He also correctly guesses their next move, which is to steal a star drive, patent pending, trademark, and share it with the monarchy, which would even the war.
Yeah, the star drive is a new tech that slants the favor far too much for the Church, and they're going to win the war with it. For those that don't have access to Google or you're walking, the Lord Papal, he's like a super muscular dude in a purple suit with a red cape, and he has kind of a soft skull head. Like I said, it reminds me kind of Thanos meets Bone.
Or a shmoo.
It's all white, and it's just a great, like, sci-fi, crazy comic book. It's completely, in some ways, it could be completely ridiculous, but I love it.
I drew him so many times as, like, a 12, 13, and 14-year-old. I used to like to copy panels, draw them out of the book. Fun. So, Dreadstar and Darklock show themselves in a crowded metropolis on some planet as a diversion to take the attention while Willow, Skeevo, and Eddie elsewhere steal the star drive. And they do.
Yeah, it was a nice fake out. I like how they play upon the arrogance of their opponent who's only gonna look for this guy. And then it's more great. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the beginning of the prequels, not to tie this too much to Star Wars, but when Obi-Wan and Darth Vader are fighting, trying to get after the sniper, and there's all the air cars, and they jump from one to the other, and it's kind of like a Coruscant-type advanced civilization world.
Yeah, it's a great chase, and Vanth and Syzygy are fighting off the attackers, but Papal surprises everyone and orders a nuking of the entire city, even though it's his own citizens, to try to get Vanth and Syzygy.
That was pretty wild.
Yeah, and they survive in a mystical bubble in a sub-sewer, and Vanth carries them out, you know, cursing Papal in the last sequence.
Yeah, that was a pretty heavy one. I really liked it. The only thing I would have done without is he's like, okay, we're nuking the city, and then release a press release that it was terrorists and we killed them and whatever. And then there's one panel where he has like this smile about it. And I'm like, if I could have one thing, I get it, he's a bad guy, but he doesn't need to like laugh that he nuked a whole city. It seems to put him over the top a little for me.
Issue 4 has Dreadstar and company returning to the monarchy, having mass-produced the instrumentality's star drives to give to the monarchy to even the war.
But what they don't know is that the monarchy hired Darth Vader, who dyed himself red, but looks very, like, very much like a Chaikin Darth Vader in red.
That's not the Masked Marauder?
King Gregzor has this mysterious red-cloaked and armored visor, a intelligence officer and confidant and consulter known simply as Z. Well, Z greets our team in the what seems like it's like the palace square and dozens of cyborg soldiers, and we get to see the team flex their muscles.
Yeah, you gotta have fights in these things. It can't be all tax policy, Steve.
Yeah.
Wait, maybe I'm carrying my bitterness about another famous science fiction media property.
Starlin always figures out a way to have some fighting, though, and do some good stuff. So Z's excuse is that he heard an intercepted message that the Lord Papal sent an assassin to kill King Gregzor. And he's right. Papal did. So he asks Vanth and company to protect the king. The instrumentality assassin is this agent wearing a holographic suit that can look like anybody, and he uses subterfuge to sneak into the palace with relative ease.
And let's give some mad props to Starlin. He puts crazy texture detail on their formal wear. Not just Dreadstar, but Willow. Like, there's all these designs. And I'm like, he was drawing this. Like, I love it, but I'm like, he gave himself a lot of extra work.
Yeah.
That he did not need to. There's no Photoshop, folks. That's not Zip-a-tone. Like, he's adding all that crazy detail. I love it, but it's a lot of work.
There's a huge reception at the palace, and everyone's all dressed up, like you say. And the group does a mind meld, and Willow confirms that Z's armor is full of circuitry and weaponry, and not as much flesh as you would think would be needed to fill it up. The assassin moves about freely during the reception, and including walking right past Vanth boldly. He serves the king a poison drink, but Eddie intercepts it.
I think you mean Odie, Steve. I'm sticking with that. He used his kitty cat senses.
Yeah, the sense of smell tipped him off. So a big chase ensues, and Eddie has a rooftop showdown, which is one of those great Starlin-esque fight scenes where they drop the backgrounds and show a whole bunch of moves going back and forth. And then the bad guy falls off a roof and dies.
Well, falls off a roof. I think when he got punched by Odie, he fell. You make it sound like he was walking around harmlessly. No, he was in a fight and got knocked off the roof.
The issue ends with a failed attempt at Papal's life by his general, because of the whole nuking of the town. One of his generals who was on the ship and witnessed it had family down there. So he tried to kill Papal, and, you know, he himself is incinerated. And it ends with Papal cursing Dreadstar, just like Dreadstar was cursing him at the end of the previous issue.
Yeah, I got some Skeletor vibes on that. Felt like...
Issue 5 has Dreadstar starting to wonder if Z might be his old partner in crime, Akhnaton. And Lord Papal sends a team to take out Syzygy, Odie, and Skeevo while they're on a mission to buy TV time at what turns out to be the broadcast satellite station for both empires. It's all part of Plan M, guys.
Well, there's a little bit of story that, if you want to put a slant on it, has it. The king complains about his impotence and his failure to serve his people. And it turns out that the media works both sides by providing biased propaganda to each empire, and they get paid both ways. And that's why they're like, well, they'll just take our money too and do whatever they want, because they're, you know, dishonest. All they want to do is make money. They don't believe in any of this stuff.
So while they're hanging out at the TV broadcast satellite station place, Syzygy gets ambushed and incapacitated. So it's up to Eddie and Skeevo to save him. And they have to fight Two-Ton.
I think you mean Stern, honey.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a Two-Ton is a giant hulking humanoid, and there's a chase through this space station that's totally reminiscent of Bernie Wrightson's bit in the first Heavy Metal movie that has the giant Hanover Fist becoming a hulking mass and chasing after Captain Stern.
Yeah, that's what I like. But it's well, I mean, it's fun. The, you know, the Katmandu has to figure out how to trick him.
Starlin and Wrightson were friends, and Starlin even mentions Aldo Gorney, who is the Wrightson-drawn backup feature over a couple of issues when they first arrive on the station. In the end, Eddie takes care of Two-Ton, and then Syzygy wakes up and banishes the other guy, the Cardinal Spider, to another dimension.
And it's total Star Wars. They have to dress in outfits of the bad guys to sneak on the ship and everything. Lots of fun. Lots of wild capers, counterbalancing the extreme violence and blowing up entire cities.
Issue 6 is Plan M on the cover, like giant, like it's a Will Eisner thing or a Monty Python meaning of life coming out of the ground or something. Finally. Plan M, yeah. The Interstellar Press is covering a remote monarchy mining colony whose suffering from instrumentality blockade. And there's this viral epidemic going on that medicines could help if only they could get through. So Dreadstar and company are tasked in getting it there. It's all part of Plan M, don't worry. And so they do some fancy flying and they make it through. They land on the planet and they deliver the supplies. It's all covered by the media. And then there is Maxilon.
The Magnificent.
Maxilon, a unseen crew member, strolls out and gives this moving speech to the crowd. Maxilon.
Are you sure it's not the Beyonder?
Yeah, it sure looks like him.
Needs a little more curl in the hair.
Yeah, that's right.
But Maxilon, there's your plan M. Who is he? Skiva wants to know. You know, it seems like he is set up to be a savior, someone that the people can turn to as an alternative to the church gods.
And he's really like a magical orator. And what I thought was a wise choice is we don't actually get any of the speech.
No.
Because it's wise not to have that, because it would not probably live up to what he's selling it to be.
Right.
So you just see it in a couple of panels, and they describe this. It moves everyone to tears and makes you forget who you are.
After the speech, they're all gathered around, and Vanth shows the rest of the gang just what makes Maxilon tick. He's a robot. Right? It all makes sense. First they needed the money for Plan M, then they needed the tech, then they needed the airtime to get their message out. Sneaky.
They got so much money.
So in issue 7, Maxilon is, I mean, he's a hit. He's showing up and giving one spectacular speech after another and really filling that role. That the church was providing as far as where to put your faith. Lord Papal and his techno-psychic guy, Meslo, they're investigating. They can't find any trace of this guy's existence before last month. We also learned more about Catterlite. You were talking before about the minerals and precious metals of this galaxy. Well, there's this... It's not rare, guys. Catterlite, it's all over the place, in fact. And it's seemingly useless. But the instrumentality can't get enough of it for some reason.
And magic space minerals. That's what I want, my science fiction. Made-up stuff.
Vanth wants to know what the secret is of the Catterlite. And Meslo strategizes correctly that Vanth would want to know, because everybody else just is born here and born into the way that things are. But Vanth, being a visitor, an outsider, coming in with a fresh set of eyes, would see this and immediately be like, and question it, whereas well, everyone like else would accept it.
It's like, not that gold obviously has uses as a conductor, but it's not like it's the most useful metal. But societies have deemed that it's attractive and used it as a base for wealth, more on social agreement, especially back when gold was decided to be valuable. They didn't need conductive metals, you know, so it was ended up being a thing. So well, that was a nice kind of meta commentary on what crap's only worth, what society says it's worth in some ways, outside of food and shelter and things with obvious
So
material use.
Meslo sets up a trap in the computer database that Vanth is more than likely going to try to infiltrate. And when Vanth surfs there, he first gets a bunch of information. He learns that the Catterlite causes cancer, which it's like, oh no, Willow, you know, worked in a mining colony. And that the church knows this and just lets billions of people die from contracting, you know, a black lung disease. He also sees that the church has no uses for this Catterlite, but finds out that they do transport it all to one planet, Glaxon. I wonder what for.
And then he gets trapped in a Steve Ditko comic.
Oh, I thought it was cyberspace, like all those great classic computer visualization things.
This is the time of Tron, folks. And sure enough, Vanth gets sucked into cyberspace by Meslo. And Meslo is supreme in that environment. He's breaking Vanth up and rebuilding him over and over again until Vanth realizes it's all in his head, and he's able to strike out at Meslow, which fries Meslow. It turns out that it was Willow giving Dreadstar a boost.
Yeah, because I like that they were trying to hide her from this, and then she's just not going to be sidelined, and she just goes and kicks ass on her own. I always liked Willow. Like, she was not going to be the damsel in distress.
Not anymore, right? The last scene on Kaldor has Vanth and Willow checking up on Vanth's hunch and discovering that Akhnaton's grave is empty. So, could Z be Akhnaton?
Well, it ends with Z betraying the king and gunning him down.
Yeah, we see King Gregzor is secretly dropping a data drive off a balcony into the waiting hand of a cloaked Eddy down below catching it. And then Gregzor turns around and Z's there and just guns him down.
I like earlier when they called it a cassette.
Yeah.
We need the magic cassette. Well, anyways, I thought it was Z, by the way. Once the empty grave happens, I'm like, oh no, not Z. I thought Z was an Acticon, the transformer from Egypt, who's come back. Like, I was like, oh no, this dude, like, he's missing an arm. Hello, in the big fight.
Yep.
That guy lost his arm. He's got a lot of superpowers.
It was rumored that he came from another galaxy.
Yeah, he, he could have survived. Like, he lived for, not just in the suspended animation, but in regular time, he lived for at least 100,000 years, because that's how long the war took in the first comic. And
And he gives it up on the last page of issue 7, too, that he is totally intent on vengeance on Vanth Dreadstar.
Yeah.
You know. Issue 8 opens with Z secretly meeting with Lord Papal at a remote location where he gives Papal the goods on all of the monarchy defenses. It's going to be a slaughter, you guys.
Yeah, make sure your general's not in the tank for the other side.
He also gives Papal one request. Don't bomb the palace, because that's where Z will be killing Dreadstar.
I don't know how you trust that guy. He, like, nuked his own city. But anyways, I guess they make a deal.
So while setting up a new base camp on a remote planet, Vanth gives a recap of the whole Metamorphosis Odyssey from Epic Illustrated and the Dreadstar graphic novel, which, you know, because he didn't live through the price stuff to be able to report on that. And it's over 11 pages here, guys. You get the Osirosians, the Zygaudians, the war, Akhnaton, euthanizing the whole Milky Way, and all that. Like, now we need to know as readers who Akhnaton is so that we understand the accusation that it might be Z.
Yeah, it was a little dense. I don't know. I mean, you have to know, but I don't know if there would have been a way to maybe bleed that out over the previous two issues or something. I don't know. I mean, I'm sitting reading it, so it didn't really bother me, but I did feel it was a lot, much like that first issue.
Eddie's intelligence from the king reveals that the reduced monarchy defenses totally leaves their throne world vulnerable. So he goes for the next intelligence drop, but instead Z is waiting, and there's a whole chase and everything, but eventually Eddie gets shot up by Z.
But he lets him live.
Eddie gets recovered at the end, and Vanth sets off to face Z while the throne world of the monarchy gets invaded and conquered.
And that was the end of the first omnibus.
Whoa.
Issues 9 and 10 feature an experimental coloring technique that was at times successful with, like, watercolor-esque washes and color blends and stuff, but also seemed to bleed and thicken black lines and kind of overcrowd areas of detail because of the bleeding. It was abandoned after issue 10.
Reminds me more of Valiant Comics, honestly.
I wonder if that was one of the reasons why they split the omnibus there. Because it really is, I don't have a problem with it, but it is jarring when you're reading these in order, when you jump from 7 to 8, and it looks completely different. So I wonder if that was part of maybe not just strict page, maybe it was strict page count, but it seemed like it was nice to split. Because when I went to the other omnibus and looked, I'm like, whoa, this isn't what it looked like. I mean, like you say, I don't have a problem with it per se, but it does seem kind of flatter too. Like everything's not really washed out, but muted maybe.
Yeah, I mean, and it almost creates like a fuzzy out of focus effect around some of the thicker black lines. I think that was the problem for me. So in these issues 9 and 10, Vanth confronts Z. He tries to talk it out, but Z wants his revenge, and they battle. Vanth is protected by his sword, and Z is protected by his force field, so it kind of goes back and forth. King Gregzer enters, and while Vanth turns his back on him to protect him from Z, Gregzer betrays him. He's become a cyborg being that's just like Gregzor's head, and the rest of his body is all robotic, and it's all controlled by Z. It's really creepy.
Yeah, but his head is still the king, so he's still kind of the whining, impotent king that he always was.
Vanth gets captured, and he's strung up and left to die by Z alongside an immobilized Gregzer and a big bomb.
Which is not describing your feelings about the comic. But
And it's here that Z reveals that he's not Akhnaton, guys. In fact, he is the last Zygotian. See, he was a scientist charged with exploring, like, the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy, looking for the next suitable worlds to conquer. And once the plan went into effect to blow the Infinity Horn and destroy the galaxy, because he was on the outskirts, he actually had a chance to make a run for it, and did, and watched the events from afar, escaping death. He follows Akhnaton and Vanth to Kaldor, puts himself in suspended animation, and he leaves there and joins the monarchy. And like 30 years later, while Vanth is having his farming life with Delilah, Z rises the intelligence ranks and becomes the chief intelligence officer, and he is the one who convinces King Nellor to raid Kaldor, purely to hurt Vanth. So it was him all the time, he's responsible, and that's why Vanth's wife was strung up the way she was.
And also all the cat people killed. Now, were you faked out too? Did you think it was an Akhnaton?
Back in the day? Yeah.
Yeah.
Back in the day, I thought it was, yes. But I remembered. So, fortunately, after Z leaves them to allow the bomb to go off, and he's gonna, you know, leave town, get out of Dodge, a destroyed ship from the dogfight that's happening over the city happens to crash into the palace, sending rubble down all over the place that frees Vanth and traps the body of the already immobilized Gregzer. Vanth pretty easily defuses the bomb, and then he respectfully brings Gregzer to his chambers to die as a king. This guy, I mean, they say it over and over again, guys. This guy never had a chance.
Oh, please. He's a little whiny baby.
Not a bad guy, but
no.
Just not, never was shown how to lead. Vanth then chases after Z, and after he adds some gaudy war paint along the way. Oh, and he takes a jetpack, although he doesn't put it on. Dreadstar catches up with Z, and they fight again for 11 more pages, guys.
Yeah, well, what happened to all the words? I thought the first issue promised lots of words.
Just take some of those words and put them in this issue.
Replace the words with the new coloring.
And Dreadstar's team had to leave him there because of the attack, so he's on his own.
Yep. And so for 11 pages, they fight before Vanth engages his trap, which is to lead Z to a particular corridor and then remotely turn on the jetpack that shoots out like a projectile right into Z's back. Then Vanth can pounce on him with his power sword and hit him with the sword over and over and over again across the whole page until the force field finally fails.
So he doesn't come back with a giant impression of a jetpack having went into his back.
So this part is brutal. Instead of running him through with the sword, now that he's got him where he wants him, instead he goes and gathers up a length of a large chain and proceeds to beat Z to death with it over the course of three more pages.
Very Jason Todd of him.
I mean, Z does fight back and all, but it's still really brutal. The issue ends with Vanth successfully avenging Gregzor, his wife, and the cat people of Kaldor, and he makes his escape off-world. And Lord Papal, celebrating their victory over the monarchy and the beginning of galaxy-wide Inquisition, where billions will die.
Yeah, the church won.
Yeah, I mean, think of Vanth's plan. First, he kind of neutered the monarchy and told them to, like, pull back. And then within a few years, the instrumentality totally wiped them out. Oops. It was all because of Z. So, to be continued in a not-too-future episode of Indie Comic Book Noise, right, guys?
Well, it depends on Kevin. We got to find out if he's on board. What did he thought? This is his first time.
It's all right.
About halfway through the next 10 issues is probably around where I stopped reading comics and jumped out. So
you're like, Dreadstar isn't doing it for me anymore.
No, Dreadstar did. We got to the big showdown between Papal and Dreadstar, which is coming. But you'll see the book takes a obvious, more superhero-y turn in the next bunch of issues. But
the thing is, with the Dreadstar and Company things, it tells you there's another Dreadstar out there, and he's, like, wearing a superhero outfit, and I'm like, okay, something obviously happens in this book later on.
Yep. It all makes sense story-wise, and Starlin is great about, I want to say maintaining his own continuity, but he, you know, we've seen him change things around, too, to suit the characters. But it the little pieces that are in play, finding out what the Catterlite does, the showdown with Papal, way down the line, beyond even the books I think we plan to cover, Syzygy lives out his whole destiny and lives out scenes that were in that initial vision that he had way back in The Price. I just love Starlin's grand epic, and when he introduces elements, they don't not pay off somewhere. Like, they matter. They come back around. There was a reason for that. I like that. Some people can weave these big epics, but there are these things that are put in and it never pays off. And with Starlin, I feel like he knows how to make these epics pay off. And I think he later did that again with his Thanos stuff, even though they kept having him do another one.
I enjoyed, like I said, the wordiness aside, I enjoyed the issues a lot. It was a fun return. I also read the 10 issues, then I went back and read the other stuff. And it works reading it out of order. Yes, you know, there aren't a few surprises, but it's well told enough that I felt that you can read it kind of out of order if you don't care that knowing the surprise, some of the twists and turns, but you're pretty much guaranteed Dreadstar was going to make it, so the rest of them are up for question.
And we really glossed over so many story elements that make the series be as meaningful that it is. I mean, there are sequences in the Metamorphosis Odyssey where Akhenaten seeks out the closest he can get to a higher power in a dimensional plane and has the argument with him, like, is what I'm doing just? Is this the right thing to do? And it's such a fascinating exchange. I really enjoyed how he played with it. Was it a vision? Did he really speak to the next best thing to God? Hard to know. And the same thing when Syzygy is doing his training of Dreadstar and they're having the different discussions and stuff, and some of the quieter moments with Willow, the Wonder Man and Beast buddy relationship that Skivo and Eddie have together is really fun. There's a lot and even the stuff on the instrumentality, when we jump to the instrumentality for a few pages and you're in like Command Central and Lord Papal is talking to his seconds and stuff, there's all really good information there, and those scenes are cool.
Well, to give the listeners some perspective, we went over, this was over 500 pages of material. I mean, obviously that includes the your peremptory stuff. So there's a lot of pages of comics that are buried into the quick summary. And even the 10 issues alone is a nice chunk. But I was curious if Kevin is still going to read like the next one, or if he's...
Yeah, I wasn't bad. I mean, it doesn't seem incredibly dated or anything.
I was surprised at that, too. How I felt like it really hummed along well. And like Steve said, all these different elements end up paying off in a way that's fun. And aside from the data dumps, it really isn't that wordy a comic, generally. He does tend to lean in. Although, same when it started, the first bit of the metamorphosis is also kind of wordy, setting up.
Yeah.
And I think that's because he only had a couple of pages. You know, it's appearing in an anthology and you don't have a lot of time. And also, as you say, that was a bit of the fashion back then. But that might, if he was ever going to rework it, I think he might rework to not make that such a data dump and those different things. But I'm also glad he didn't rework it in any significant way. Like, there's no need to revisit everything.
And some pages might be data dumps, but then you also get 11-page fight sequences and chase scenes. So there really is, he does take the time to let it breathe. There are those, you know, he takes up real estate in the book to take the time to do gags and stuff too, right? Like even at the very end of this, when Dreadstar is trying to leave the throne world after it's been taken over by the instrumentality, a bunch of soldiers come over and surround him, and when he shows his sword and they realize it's Vanth Dreadstar, he doesn't have to lift a finger and they all go running, and he's like, oh, cool. And he just walks off, you know? And that took up panel space in the book, but he takes the time to let it breathe in these times in between the heavy stuff too. That there's enough joking around, there's enough lighthearted, comic-y fun that's happening. One of my favorites as a youth, nostalgic for the time that I read it and being there over the long haul, picking it up as a bi-monthly book, rereading it over and over again, drawing panels from it, having Starlin become a favorite creator, leaving comics for years and having it be Starlin that brought me back into the fold. When I saw that on a 7-Eleven spinner rack, I saw Thanos on the cover of a Silver Surfer issue and popped it open and saw that Starlin was writing Silver Surfer? Wow. Maybe I should pick this up. But Starlin's been a favorite creator ever since, and this work continues on its epicness, like we will cover in a future episode of Indie Comic Book Noise, after we have time to digest the next chunk. And look for the Ominous Press reprints, and I'm sure that they're going to be available digitally as well as in hardcover, but boy, this is certainly nice to have on the shelf as a collection like this after all these years. So I thank everyone involved for the time they spent doing it and making
it. Yeah, and there's pinups and there's extra stuff in there too as well.
Yep, back matter. Gotta love the back matter. All right, that's another episode of Marvel Noise, even though the Marvel was kind of in quotes, right?
Hey, epic counts.
Glenn M.
Tune again next time. We'll have some more malevolence from the mighty Marvel masterworks of past. Until Eddie wears a flea collar, make mine Marvel. Later.
Pretty soon there was a crowd that was getting pretty loud, and the men all said there'd be no work today. But the owner wouldn't budge. He just said, down in Cold Creek. Dirty business down in Cold Creek. This morning. Just when they heard the sound that rumbled from the ground, and everyone went rushing for the door.